My name's Terry. I'm an addict. And I'm recovering today thanks to Jimmy K. And Jimmy had a lot of friends, and he had a small circle of friends in Los Angeles, and then there were volunteers that helped at the office, and I would like to give you one of the main volunteers that worked with Jimmy a lot. I'd like to introduce Vaughn.
Hi, everybody. My name is Fawn. I'm an addict. I'm really wired here. Okay. And I'm a very grateful member of Narcotics Anonymous. It's a privilege and an honor to be here tonight. I really want to thank the city of Nashville for asking me to come out here and share my experience, strength, and hope. My history. It's not a convention. And just, I've had such a good time here, and I can't stop eating. I must have gained a whole dress size since I've been here, but I've been having such a good time, and I'm staying with such nice people, and I've met so many warm and friendly people. I really want to thank everyone here for making this a very nice day for me and my friends. And you guys have done a great job. I think you should give yourselves a big hand. The one role I wrote everything down because to me, this is, I heard someone say it earlier, this is a big responsibility, and it would be very easy for me to get lost in on a trail of memories and then spend 20 minutes, in a car in Long Beach somewhere. So I don't want... So I don't want that to happen. So that's why I am, I wrote a lot of what I'm going to say down so that I can refer to it and remember, because there is a lot to remember. It's also, I want to say too, it's hard remembering the past sometimes, because to revisit the past is to relive it. And it's kind of like writing inventory. This morning I was upstairs, and after breakfast I stayed up there, and hair stuck in my mouth. I stayed up there and I was writing this down, and it felt like I was writing inventory in a way, and I just felt my heartstrings, and it was really something. But I'll just start. The one role I shall treasure always in my heart and memory are those years when I volunteered at the World Service Office, when it was in Jimmy Kennan's house, and he was the manager. It was here that I learned how to develop what would later blossom into a great love and pride for my fellowship. I was brand new in recovery, and I was sort of, I met somebody, and very new, well, 30 days, and I met somebody in recovery. They had 5 years, and and his best friend was Jimmy. And so I spent a lot of time from that day forward at Jimmy's house. When Jimmy found out that I could type, well, that was the beginning of a very long and friendship. It was there that I learned how to care about other people and how to be useful. Jimmy said, It was there that I heard Jimmy say that if you gave NA a chance, you would never have to be alone again, you'd never have to run again, and you'd learn how to stand on your own two feet and think for yourself. One of the things, what I did for a living at that time was I was a secretary. And a secretary takes notes, transcribes meeting minutes, sets calendars, keeps appointments, files, maintains those files, and alerts those she or he works for or is entrusted to alert of key dates or times approaching. And for many years, Jimmy served as not only our fellowship's sole secretary, but I would, beyond a shadow of a doubt now, say that he served as our historian, as he saved every single scrap of paper pertaining to our history since our inception in a file system that he set up and meticulously kept up and protected. And he protected to the best of his ability until the day he died for us. I saw this filing system, and he was very protective of it because he knew how easy it was when, well, have you ever lent somebody a book around here? So I used to see how often people, well-meaning addicts who were eager to pitch in and help, who had perhaps secretarial experience or were fast typists or, say, had access to, you know, mega copy machines or, you know, fancy equipment at work, would come over and say, well, why don't you just lend me, you know, this file and I'll get it back to you in 2 days and I can have, you know, enough copies for the entire state of, you know, whatever. And, you know, as much as he would have liked to take advantage of that, he always, in the best interest of those records, would say no. They were welcome to lug that equipment over to his house. They were welcome to rent equipment and bring it over. They were welcome to spend as much time as they needed at his home at any hour of the day. But they were not allowed to remove records from the house. And that's just a rule that he set up. And that was to protect our shit. And you will find that the World Service Office that we have today, they will tell you the same thing. You wouldn't be allowed to go over there and say, here, just give me the stuff and I'll get it back to you in a couple of days. Businesses just don't work like that. So Jimmy ran the office like a business. It may have not looked like a business to you because it was in his home, but he ran it as professionally as he was capable of running it. He took it very seriously. And what a lot of people also didn't know about him was that he was a pack rat. He loved to save things, and he would save things that had anything to do with helping addicts. So if it had to do with some Joe Blow treatment center on the other side of the planet, he would save it in some file somewhere tucked away in a file that he would always have easy access to. Why? Because he could cross-reference it. Maybe someday there would be somebody that worked there that somehow would have some kind of a connection to maybe a, who knows, but somewhere in his mind he thought that that might help an addict, you know, or that might serve NA in a useful purpose. So he kept it. He kept newspaper clippings regarding that. He kept I would often wonder, why do we have this? You know, but in his mind, he kept it regardless. and he kept business cards. And he had a memory that was so keen and sharp, sharper than mine is today, that's for sure. He could remember names, dates. He could remember at the drop of a pin. It was amazing. See, the reason I remember a lot of this stuff is because I was very new, and all I knew how to do when I was over there was type and do anything that I could to help out. So there wasn't a lot for me to say or talk about. Ginny was the most pleasant person to work around. He was consistently in a good mood to work around. Most of the time, I rarely would see him sit down. He was most of the time on his feet. He liked to talk on the phone on his feet. He was always talking on the phone. The phone was always ringing. He loved talking to addicts. I would never hear him say, "Oh, fucking phone." He never used profanity, by the way. At least I never heard him use profanity. He was never aggravated by a call. He would always, he appreciated sharing the message of Narcotics Anonymous with other addicts, especially if they were from out of state. Or with anybody, you know, if they were an addict in Narcotics Anonymous or seeking recovery. And he was really good at cross-referencing people. And so he was really good with the files. Oh, this is back to the memory thing. He could, like, be on the phone, be talking to somebody, and then he'd zip right over to an open file, pull out, oh, yeah. Like if he was on the phone, like let's say with Connecticut, he could open a file and pull out a person's name from, I don't know, Rhode Island or something. And he would know, he could hook people up that way, you know, because he really believed in hooking people up. I remember that about him. Okay, I'm going to be skipping around here a lot. I'm just telling you this because a lot of times the people that knew him take that relationship for granted. So I will try to tell you as much as I can about what I knew about him. That's why I was writing everything down that I could, so that you can like know a little bit about him as a man and what he was like when he was serving you as the manager of the World Service Office. The whole time that I worked for him, he never complained and he never once bragged about anything that he did. I never knew about all the stuff that he wrote. Like, for example, I didn't know that he wrote just about everything in the little white book until after he died. I forgot to bring all the exact years that he wrote, who is an addict, what is the NA program, you know, another look, recovery and relapse, why are we here. I forgot to, I think on one or two of those he had help from Penny, but he never mentioned that, you know. He used to, he was like a philosopher. He used to, you know, take time to, you know, he'd take walks off into, like, up to the temple in La Crescenta, this Vedanta temple up in La Crescenta, or he would go to, he'd show up at meetings really early and sit at the end of a table, and he would, like, write or scribble out theories or thoughts he had about the nature of the addict or the nature of addiction or, you know, trying to understand more about what this program meant to him, or better ways to try and convey this message to addicts in writing. You know, he was very, from 1960 on, he felt it was very important to get the message on in writing, on paper, for to reach the fellowship out there. He was very meticulous, like I said. He never left files out in the open. He always returned them back to where they were. He everything had a place. He was not senile, okay? That's a bunch of baloney. I think that was just, you know, propaganda. I never would see him stress out. Like, maybe, I'm sure all of us as human beings stress out, but he would never, like, show it the way that, you know, I mean, when I stress out, you know, it's obvious. But, you know, but he would never, like, show it, you know. He was just a really good person. People that worked around him always, for the most part, came back to work with him. And, you know, there's a lot of people that volunteered in that office, and we're all very different. I mean, you've seen some of us that are here. And but I'll tell you one thing that we all have in common. We all stayed clean. And I think that is so bizarre because we, you know, not all of us are here. There's still some of us back out in California. He had a tremendous respect for women. And women appreciated him very much. They knew that he would respect them, and he took them seriously. He valued their opinions, and this was at a time when the Valley was running rampant with, you know, well, it was just a real. It was a different kind of time in recovery. You know, I'm glad that I hooked up with somebody very quickly because it was it was dangerous out there in the Valley. It was, for the most part, it was. I was a heroin addict myself, but. I didn't use with these type of people. I mean, these people were convicts. I mean, they were like out of the, you know, Folsom and San Quentin, and a lot of them were just nasty people. I mean, I remember one time this guy and this girl were going together, and she started fucking around on him, and so she just showed up at the parking lot and shot his ass, and he didn't die or anything, but my God, it was like, oh, jeez. I mean, it was serious back then, you know, and, you know, I mean, they came and got her and took her away, and, you know. He just had a shoulder wound, but still, thank God she didn't aim well. That's the kind of stuff that used to happen, you know. You didn't want to look at anybody wrong back then, and there was always some drama going on at the old Survivors Club, you know. There was always some new fight going on, you know. To tell you the truth, I grew to like the fights that were started to happen around there. It was because there were some good fist fights. it was sort of like the fire on the block. And so, and lots of dances. We always had the best, the Valley always had the best special events committees. We had good dances and lots of treatment centers. Bill must have started every recovery house in California. If it weren't for him, I don't know if half of California would be clean. But I got clean through the recovery house way. That was about the only way to get clean back then. Back then, I remember that, back then NA meetings were really small. And I had first heard about NA through AA. And this was back in 75 when I first came through a treatment house program. And I went through this one place in Pasadena. And I was there for about 2 months. And my roommate said that there was this other recovery house in Burbank where everybody was getting high and fucking. And I said, well, that's where I want to be. So I left that one, and I went to the one where they were, you know, all getting high and fucking. But when I got there, it wasn't happening. So I got myself in real big trouble. My PO violated me for leaving the first one. But Bill saved the day because he sent this goofy-looking court rep who saved me from, and I had to spend the night in jail. It was a mess. But I got out, and so then I had to go through this other place and start all over again, you know. It was just basically the same deal. They were all the same, you know. All it really was a place to, where they send you to meetings in these different vans every night. These places usually housed about 65 addicts, and they'd send about 15 vans and 15 addicts in one van to different meetings. But see, back then, NA was really small, like I was saying. And none of us had Seventh Tradition because we're all in, you know, recovery houses. And as you know, when you get clean, you get real hungry. You want to eat donuts and drink coffee. So they couldn't send us through these little tiny NA meetings where we would eat up all their donuts and drink all their coffee. Well, this was my theory. So they'd send us to these big AA meetings where we eat all their donuts. And we drink all their coffee. And then if they had a problem with that, we would jump all over them and curse them out. And, we would talk about our big, dangerous war stories, you know. And these poor alcoholics, you know, they'd have to sit there and listen to our jail stories and how we shot dope and turned tricks. And, Jesus, no wonder why they wanted to throw us out in the street. But how it backfired was that these, like I said, these treatment programs lasted 9 months, see? So what you had happening, at least my experience, was that by the time these 9 month treatment programs were over, you had all these addicts who were mostly going to AA, right? And so what happened? We're all making friends over in AA with AA sponsors now. And so it was, we're getting this sort of mixed up message, and the little NA experience that we were getting were on weekend passes, mostly to wanting to, you know, maybe, you know. Oh, come on. So anyway. No, it's not about donuts. But to go to the dances and stuff like that. So anyway, what? So this was sort of what happened. So it took a long time for so you had a lot of addicts getting clean in AA, is what I'm trying to tell you. And in the meantime, a lot of the old timers before NA was really even getting started were all getting clean in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, hell, try and picture, I heard a couple of them say, try and picture how scary it must have been being an addict and just fighting for your life. You know, if someone would have said, you know, stand on your head and you know, well, chant 1,000 goldfish, whatever, I probably would have done that too, you know. It was a desperation, you know. But anyway, I stayed clean for 2.5 years that way. And then I got thirsty. I guess because I went out and I drank and I smoked reefer. That was my reservation. And I did that for about 6 months. And when I came back, I surrendered to Narcotics Anonymous. And that was on July 21st, 1978. And during that time, I had some exposure to Narcotics Anonymous. I'd been to a convention up in San Francisco at the Jack Tar Hotel. I think that was in 1976. And that was really something. This was during the time when I thought that to stay clean, all I had to do was really go to conventions, go to dances, have a sponsor, write one inventory, and do a lot of confession. And that's how I thought I could stay clean. And I got to tell you this one funny story. How they used to decide how they were going to have the next world convention, and it was always either going to be in Northern California or Southern California. That was it. That was the two big fat choices. Was on Sunday morning after the spiritual speaker, they would have a vote. And so Southern California would get up there with their fancy proposal, and they would say, okay, we've got a steak dinner, and this is what we got, you know, and everyone would clap. And then Northern California would get up there and say, okay, well, we got a shrimp dinner at the Holiday Inn. This is what we got. And everyone would clap. And then they'd take a vote, a hand vote. And anyone that had stayed for the spiritual morning speaker, those would be the people that would vote. And this is how they'd vote for the World Convention. There would usually be about 100 people, right? About 100 people. Well, this one year, from out of the blue, this chick from Houston, comes flying down the aisle, and she comes up there with nothing in her hand, and she says, I don't know about y'all, but we really need y'all down in Houston. So if we can get you all to please come and vote for us, we'll really do some spiel like that. And we're all sitting there kind of laughing to ourselves, like thinking, boy, this girl's really got something, you know, to think that anyone would vote for her. So I think it was you, Chuck, right? Weren't you the chair that year? Yeah, it was you. You got up there and you said, it was either you or Steve, I forget. You were chair of so many things. So I think it was you. You got up and you said, okay, here's how we're going to do it, because this is major. You know, you had three people now, three cities, big decision. Okay, So he said, okay, everybody for Northern California, get on this side of the room. Everybody for Southern California, get on this side of the room. And everybody for Texas, right down the center of the room. Oh, well, there was so much commotion, chairs moving, you know, everybody, you know, you can imagine, that was pretty heavy. So everybody's, you know, and I call it like this was the day of a lot of NA tourists, you know, people that really weren't going to make it next year anyway. You know, they shouldn't have been there anyway, was my feeling. They should have probably just left quietly and let the serious voters stay. But we had to go on with this vote. So, of course, everybody from Northern California went to their side, and everybody from Southern California went to their side. And then you had all these strange people in the center of the room, right? But the weirdest thing happened. Most of the people were in the center of the room, and I'm freaking, because naturally my recovery is conventions and dances, and so I'm thinking, I don't have any money to go to Texas, especially Houston, ooh. So then all of a sudden, you know, and everybody's standing, you know, no one's sitting, right? So you have Northern California screaming over the heads of Texas to Southern California, come on, get over here. And you have Southern California screaming at Southern California, you know, you come over here, because, see, here's the deal. They started to get hip to the fact, like, let's keep it in California, right? That makes sense, right? I mean, there's only, what, 800 miles or... what is it now, 600? All your voice. All right, something like that. Okay, I never went up there if I didn't have to. All right, so... okay, so anyway, so you've got these people screaming at each other over Texas who's still just standing there, And then Southern California is saying, yeah, come on, Northern California, let's keep it in the state. And then Northern California is screaming, yeah, good idea, but why don't you come over here? And this is going back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Danny T, who's like one of these penitentiary Chicano guys, God love him, he's still clean, by the way, he gets up, when he's from Southern California, he gets up on a table, right, one of these banquet tables, takes off his shirt, and he's got this big-ass tattoo on his chest with a sombrero, you know, and he's going, Mexicans, over here! Trying to get everybody, because he's got a following, you see? He's got a following, you know? He's thinking, I'm getting my people over here, you know? Well, you know what? This went on for a while, and finally, you know, it was over. And because of both sides' refusal to budge, Houston got it. And for the rest of the convention, we were all us Californians, well, all I can remember is me in particular, wandering around the halls of the convention, the hotel, just like, oh, my God, NA's going to fold. I really thought, like, my recovery was in serious jeopardy. I mean, I really thought, like, it's gone. We've lost it. We've blown it, you know. And but, you know, thank goodness that happened, because look what's happened. Every time the World Convention moved to another state, it just tripled. I mean, the meetings, you know, just tripled in that city. And, of course, I needed a serious attitude adjustment, and I wasn't going to stay clean that way. And I went out and did some more experimenting with my deep-seated reservations. And when I did come back, I came back and made a commitment to Narcotics Anonymous. And then I met Jimmy, and then it was there that I discovered, I knew something was missing. People kept saying, what are you going to do differently this time, Vaughn? I had no idea. I mean, I thought, well, shit. Well, okay, I'll make a commitment to Narcotics Anonymous. I'll do that, you know. But they kept saying, so what are you going to do different? Because I thought I was doing, you know, okay. So then I thought service work. That's what I'll do. I'll do service work. And I thought, well, you know, so through watching Jimmy and through being of service there, I learned that that's what had been missing in my recovery, you know, that being of service to others, you know, was going to, took me out of myself, you know. And I learned, you know, I realized that I really didn't know that much about love. And I didn't know how I was going to learn about love either. And so how I learned about love was like sort of similar like to taking care of a plant. You know how when you get a plant, you have to water it all the time and you have to kind of like pluck away the dead leaves on it and, you know, just make sure it sits on the right sunlight and just take care of it. You know, some people play music to it. I don't get that crazy, but, you know, I take care of my plants. And so that's kind of like the way that I looked at NA service, you know, and through doing that with my responsibilities that I was entrusted to do in service work, I slowly learned how to love NA. And that's how I learned how to love NA, through just taking care of my little responsibilities. And how I learned how to do that was just the little things that, the little chores that he would give me to do at a time. And I took such great pride in doing them. He had a way of giving, delegating work that made people feel, you know, he talked a lot about creative freedom. And what that means is not having someone over you dictating how you're going to do it. Have you ever been on a committee where you've had a control freak as the chairman, you know, telling you every single way how you're going to do it, when you're going to do it? It takes all the fun out of it, doesn't it? It makes you feel like, well, you know, I think with addicts, the joy in the work is like, you know, all the steps are that way too. You know, it's like we get a chance to come up with our own higher power. We get a chance to think of ways of how we're going to help the newcomer. You know, what's the best way I can help this sponsee? There's all kinds of ways. If I want to get up here and identify as a recovered, if I can call myself anything I want to, and you guys have to just take it, you know? I mean, and you might not like it, but you know what? You have to, the tradition says, you have to tolerate me, or you have to have compassion for me. That is the sign of an experienced member. And it's not about setting rules and regulations and all that, I've come to find out. Because eventually that new person will get a sponsor or will be guided in a good way. The thing is not to humiliate them or to drive them out of the room. And it's that way, I guess, with everything. He knew this, I guess, about all the volunteers that came to the office, you know. It was just a joy to work with him. Back in those days when I first started working at the office, there was a time when I can remember it was just so much fun. I remember a time when... you know, we used to all do things like, like the little white books. They would come in from the printer, and the volunteer nights, I think, were Tuesday and Thursday. And so a lot of the volunteers would get there, and we'd all sit in the living room, and they would have to be stapled in two places, you know, in the center of the book, and then they'd have to be folded. Then another job that he had was that Ditto machine, which, you know, with the purple ink. So he had somebody helping him do that. I think that's one of Chuck's sponsees, and he's still around. Then there was all those IPs. They had to be folded in threes. So there was that crew, you know. And then so while we're all doing that, the little crews that were in charge, we'd all be talking around, sitting in little circles, talking about our days or talking about recovery or step work or just, you know, talking shit, you know. And I can remember those being the best times in my life. It felt really good to be in his house. We were so lucky to have somebody like him to, I feel personally like we were really blessed to have somebody like him to be the guardian of all our stuff, you know, or to, well, there's just so much to say about this man. So whenever I used to hear negative things about him, I knew they weren't true. And so the core of people that worked with him had a tendency to protect him from hearing that stuff because we didn't want him to hear ugly shit. It just wasn't necessary. So a lot of times we just didn't want to hear it. But what would happen is it was very hurtful to hear. Over the years, I've often wondered why there was animosity towards the office, and from some individuals and some factions, through certain periods. And I have my theories. One of them was that Jimmy had absolutely no animosity towards Alcoholics Anonymous. He got clean in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1950, and he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to go to, when he had time, he would often visit and attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he loved and believed that in Narcotics Anonymous, and he would constantly tell us that Narcotics Anonymous was a fellowship that could stand on its own two feet, that it was a fellowship that was separate and apart from Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, see, he didn't intend for that to mean anything else, okay? But when you tell that to someone like me, who's a newcomer, who has nothing invested anymore in Alcoholics Anonymous, what am I going to do with that? My thinking is, oh, yes, Narcotics Anonymous, yeah, one fellowship, one disease, one program, addiction, right. So I go out and I start telling my friends, hey, fuck that AA shit, man. You know? You don't need to go to AA and OA and GA and FA and all that. Just, you're an addict, right? You're a dope fiend, right? NA, come on, we got to get it going, you know? I was really enthusiastic about Narcotics Anonymous. I wanted everybody to be enthusiastic about Narcotics Anonymous, goddammit. And so I was just behaving like a newcomer in service work. So now, would I tell Jimmy that's the way I was behaving out here? Hell no. But this is the way that I was, you know. So, but meanwhile, out here in the community at large, people might be thinking, who is that fucking chick, you know? Oh, that's that girl that's working over there with Jimmy, you know? That's what he's probably telling her, you know? That's what he's telling all those people coming out of that house, you know? So I looking back, I'm thinking, wow, you know, maybe he took the heat. Maybe the people that were his, you know, that loved him the most probably hurt him the most, you know? Sometimes I think of that too. Because Jimmy the man, he was such a good person. And, you know, and I think too, when I met him, he had as much time as me, as I do now. And there's no way that I come close to, you know, the type of person he was. I mean, he wasn't a god, okay? He was, like Chuck said, he wasn't perfect. I mean, first of all, you could never manipulate or control this person. And I think that's what irked some people. When they figured out, like the smart dope fiends, you know who you are. When you can't manipulate or control somebody, you know how pissed off you get? Well, you either keep trying or you walk away. So those people, I noticed, had a hard time with him. Like, you know, they didn't like the fact that they couldn't take stuff out of his house. There were just things like that. Somebody had to stand up for our traditions, you know, and you know what? He always did. You know, you could always count on somebody that would stand up for Narcotics Anonymous and our traditions, and it was him. Why did he stand up for them? Because he saw how NA almost folded in 1959. He saw how, because of egos and big shotism, how NA almost went down the tubes, and he recognized why that happened. So he wasn't going to let that happen again. So call it overcautiousness, call it what you want, but he made a decision, and that was his decision. And his creative, his simple way of staying clean for him was simple, just being of service. That was simple. It was easy. I have this book here. Oh. One of the things that he wrote at one of the anniversary dinners, before they had conventions, they had these anniversary dinners. This was before I got here. But he wrote this. And for you old-timers like Jack and some of you others that are here, these are some notes that he wrote to share. And so maybe this will bring back some good memories for you guys, but I wanted to, this is for you old timers. This is what he wrote. Not so instant recall. Remember when newcomers would drive around the block where the meeting was held 4 or 5 times to make sure it wasn't staked out? Remember when all we had was a rabbit circuit? We hopped from one house or apartment to another every week to hold our meetings. Remember when we almost scared a family and a newcomer out of their wits when 7 of us drove to Long Beach on a late 12-step call? Remember when most of the gang persuaded Russ C. on the porch of his Burbank apartment? And after the meeting last, we had at Dupar's and Johnny's on Friday nights. But who remembers the 3 characters who lay across the railroad tracks at midnight, their heads on the rail, watching for hours for the first Russian Sputnik in the California sky? So I don't know who was who would remember that, but maybe someone's here that night who would remember that. Let me see, what else? He also had an outline here where he wrote down some things on years. I don't want to read that. This whole notebook is just full of, like, his writings, you know. If people want to look at them after this meeting and just see what I mean by, like, how he would just write, you know, there's writings here that I think should have gone into our book, you know, about the traditions, about, oh, just everything. They're so beautiful. For those of you who never believed he was an addict, his thing was codeine, pills, and alcohol. I remember a lot of this because, like I said, I did a lot of watching, and I was also secretary to the area. I was secretary to the region. I was secretary to the conference. I was secretary at the office. So I was always writing shit down. So, and then not only writing it down, then I had to type it down. Then I had to, if it was transcribed, then I'd have to, you know, do the backup thing with the tapes. And Jimmy would always proof it. Oh, he was always very, he wanted things to go out perfectly. He never believed in things going out, you know, wrong. You know, he wanted things to go out right. With the meeting directories, his dream was that NA would be a worldwide fellowship. That was his vision. That NA would. There's a letter here from Australia. He used to love talking about Australia, and he carved our first NA. He designed our NA symbol. When he had TB of the throat, and one time he was in the hospital, and it was there that he carved it on a piece of leather. And the World Service Office has that. He was always thinking about NA, and the people that were with him when he died in the hospital know that he died talking about NA. That's how much he loved us. And he loved addicts. I feel like, I mean, I'm really grateful for my recovery, but I feel like sometimes, like, my life is about just sharing how I knew him. I believe that I'm his secret weapon. I do. Because he used to talk about that, you know, like when the shit was hitting the fan and they were going to stick it up his ass. I remember we used to say, well, Jimmy, come on, man. What are you going to do? And he goes, don't worry. I got a secret weapon. And we used to kind of laugh, you know. And so a couple of us would say, okay, well, where's the secret weapon? We need the secret weapon now. It's time to bring it out, you know. And, don't worry. Got the secret weapon. Well, I guess there just was no secret weapon because, as you know, things just kind of folded up, you know. And so last year, my dear girlfriend in L.A. said, you know what, Fawn? And I said, what? Because I was, you know, I'm always asked to do these history workshops, and it just ends up being a story about Jimmy Kay. And she says, I think you're his secret weapon. And I said, really? She goes, yeah, because you just carry around all this shit. And you just keep talking about him, keep talking. But you know what? It's my pleasure to talk about him. Because I know that he's probably the one decent good man I ever knew. And we were so lucky to have him with us. And you know what? I even forgive, for the most part, I forgive the people who did, you know, who were part of all of that crap, because it was just such a, you know, who knows? I don't know, because I often think, well, how come they didn't make amends, you know? How do they stay clean, you know? Maybe they're in denial. That's got to be it. I mean, I don't know. But I just don't know. But I know that he, and a lot of them are dead now anyway. yeah. So, but you know, we all got to die, huh? But at least he died with a clean slate, you know, and he left, look what he left, you know, I mean, he really left everything, and you know what, as soon as he died, all the fucking files went to shit, you know, everybody started stealing them, selling them, you know, they're all fucked up, you don't have, you know why you don't have any history? Because half the shit's on the West Coast, half of it's on the East Coast, half of it's on eBay, half of it's in the World Service Office. You'll never have it right because the people, some of the people who have it don't even know what they got, you know? And it's sad. So maybe one day it'll all be really, really concise, you know? Who knows? But in the meantime, There's enough of it. I think those beautiful tapes that the World Service Office have is a good beginning. And as far as all the shit that happened in the past and all that, you know, I think all of us are capable of being ugly sometimes. And I think Jimmy would have wanted us to forgive each other. I really do. I won't, but he would have. And I don't have to, you know? The one thing that I've learned is I live pretty well with resentment. Very well. I do. I do. I mean, right through it, I did. You know, I sleep very well. I don't even really resent anybody anymore. It sort of just disappeared. I mean, now I see the people and sometimes I even feel kind of sorry for some of the people. But I don't really give it much thought anymore. All I know is that I love my fellowship. I love Narcotics Anonymous. I don't regret ever, you know, making a decision to be a full-fledged member. When I make a decision to sponsor a newcomer or sponsor a woman in NA, I don't hesitate for a minute to tell them to make a commitment to Narcotics Anonymous. We have a beautiful fellowship. We have everything to offer someone. I know we can stay clean here, and we have beautiful steps and a rich history. And, shit, man, we got it, you know, and we're all over the damn place. I mean, if Jimmy were alive today, well, he would be very happy that we're all over the place, and I know he would be very proud. So I'm really tired now. Oh, hey, you know what? When his son bought a, there's so much more I'm leaving out, you know, I'm sorry, but there really is a lot, you know. His son was very involved in getting the message out to the troops in Vietnam. Oh, shit, he used to write letters from the hospital bed. Used to do so much, right, Chuck? Bill? I mean, anybody who knew him he was just a fiend for this program. I mean, and, oh, I know, one more thing. Just one more quick story. He would give us, the day that two more stories, real quick. The letter from New York City that came in from Terry. We were all in the office, and that letter that Terry Ryan talks about that came in from New York City, well, you know what? There was a time when a lot of addicts from New York, the only way to get clean was to get the hell out of the state and come over on the West Coast to get clean, right? So there were some New Yorkers that were in California that were staying clean. And a couple of them were working in the office. So that day, that letter came in, and Jimmy was so excited, man. I mean, he was so psyched. And he came in with a letter in his hand. He goes, okay, everybody, I got a letter here. Everybody loosen up. So we all turned, and he read the letter. And one member had tears in his eyes. He was a New Yorker. And when we read the last part, where Terry, actually the last line was something, and if you don't like it, go fuck yourself. We all started laughing, and we were just so excited because by then, like, New York City was like the last place, you know, on the map in the States to get it. And it was an exciting day, and that's the kind of stuff that used to... That was like a fix for that man, you know? I mean, it really got us, but, oh, man, that was just like everything to him. The other thing I remember was that he once gave me a letter, this letter that came in from Alaska from this guy, and he had sent this guy in nowhere, Alaska. I forget the name of the city, but he sent this guy a starter kit. And this guy, he was communicating with this guy, and there was nobody else in Alaska in this city at the time that was staying clean. And this guy wanted to start a meeting. So this guy writes Jimmy a letter, and it was set up in increments of time in 15 minutes, right? And it was sort of like, all right, 8 o'clock. I set up the chairs. 8:15, the coffee pot is on. The hot water will be boiling soon. You know, it was that real simple, you know. 8:30, the door is open. But it was like real, like, you were like really there with this guy. You really felt like he was right there with his pen and paper, like, while... You know, this was like instant, like. So this went on. I don't know the exact everything, but you can imagine what was going on. 9 o'clock, no one's here yet. You know, 9:15, 9:30. This was an hour and a half meeting. Because most of the meetings were an hour and a half. 10 o'clock. Well, no one's here. I'm going to break down the meeting now, but I'll be here next week. You know, it was so cool, man, you know. And he shared that letter with me, and I think he knew that I would be, like, so just as moved by that letter as he was. And those are the kind of letters that kept him going, you know. And I think those are the kind of letters that... Would keep you going too. You know, those are the kind of members that we had. You know, those were our pioneers in Narcotics Anonymous back then. And God, you know, those are the people. I'm sure that guy's still around, you know. If he is, if you ever meet him, God, I hope he just introduces himself to me, because I would really love to give him a big hug. Anyway, this video, his son once bought a video camera, and Jimmy was so psyched. He wanted his son to, like, tape everything. So this video gets a little, it's sweet because, you know, if for most of you who might have seen it at lunchtime, he gets into, like, describing his plants in the front yard. And if you notice, the planters in his front yard, they're all football helmets. He was very creative in the way that he, you know, did things. But anyway, here's the scene